Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With us today, we have Daniel McAdams, our co-host. Daniel, good to see you this morning.
Good morning, Dr. Paul. How are you this morning?
All set and ready to go.
All right.
I understand there's a little trial going on, and we don't know the results. And,
yeah.
We're not going to talk much about it. We talked about it before.
Yeah.
Unless there's breaking news,
yeah.
The whole thing was closed down and everybody admitted it was a farce,
yeah.
And they pulled it off and it wasn't even April Fool's Day.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, history will show that it was a farce maybe, but
yeah,
not right
it'll
now.
Take a while.
But I want to talk about something that has not been a farce. It's been around and it's always been a pet peeve of mine. And there are more people starting to realize it's not the greatest organization ever. And when you look back, even from the beginning, and I'm talking about NATO, this wonderful plan to have peace in our time. We fought that horrible war. And so as the World War II passed, you know, it was over. You know, the Western nations, mainly the Atlantic type of countries in Europe, it was mainly for Eastern Europe, you know, to be prepared so that they'd never have to be unprepared if they had to fight Russia again. So this has been around for a long time, but it's completely morphed into something that it's always has nothing really to do with defense or peace. It has to do with how does a special interest group manipulate politics and budgets so they make a lot of money.
Yeah.
I bet you that's one of their top agendas, you know, and it goes on again. And they have to scare people. And ever since World War II, we certainly have been the wealthiest nation. We still probably are, but losing a lot of our wealth. And the wealth guaranteed that we could have the reserve currency of the world. And therefore, we were the peacemakers in a fictitious way, and we could run the world, and we adapted to the whole principle of us having an empire. And that's been going on for all these years, but there's more challenges than ever before, and that is what they're trying to celebrate right now, but there's still a lot of questions remaining about NATO.
Yeah, let's put up this article that we both read and found it interesting. It's written by Ramsey Baroud in Counterpunch magazine. We saw it on Zero Hedge, so they get credit. But the title is NATO's Never-Ending War. The 75-year-old bully is faltering. And it's a very interesting deep dive into NATO. If you go to the next clip, essentially what Baroud is talking about is that NATO was sort of founded on a myth. And a myth that there is a NATO community, part of the world community, he writes, linking the strength of the former to preserving the peace for the latter. So NATO, critically important to preserving peace in the world community. And he said, as innocuous as such language may seem, it introduced a paternal relationship between the U.S.-dominated NATO and the rest of the world. Thus, it allowed the powerful members of the organization to define, on behalf of the rest of the world, and often outside the umbrella of the U.N., such notions as peace, security, threat, and ultimately terrorism. So the idea that the U.S. used NATO essentially to define the relationship with the rest of the world, and then, and you make mention of this very often, the very first example of NATO was the idea that we have got to be involved in Korea because we have to counter communist expansionist aggression. So that was the first move that NATO made.
It was slightly out of territory, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Go all the way
North Atlantic.
Over there. And of course, they had more influence there than they had in Vietnam. And Vietnam was, you know, a total disaster for foreign policy. And yet we pulled ourselves out of that, mainly because we were so wealthy and aggressive. But, you know, the war was totally lost. Americans, 40,000 Americans were killed. And this to me was, you know, a tragedy. Korea turned out that we got involved much sooner, and the United Nations was involved, and finally we worked it out that we would not allow the Koreans to make their own decisions. When we walked away from Vietnam, it was left up to the Vietnamese to decide. And, you know, for years, the French and the Americans used all this effort to fight and kill and bring Vietnam into the Western orbit and the modern age. And all we did was cause devastation. But when it ended and we had to leave, all of a sudden I've often made the comment, because I said much more was achieved in peace than all that war and all that spending, because all of a sudden we could go to Vietnam, we were in business with them. It's far from a perfect situation, but what a difference between the 60s when you know, the people got drafted and people died over that. So, but in Korea, we were really active and we had the international governments. But here in North Korea, and communism still exists and it still is a threat. You know, I just think the difference should be evident. But there are some people who still brag about how wonderful it was that we stopped it and produced all this great wealth in South Korea. But South Korea did—they did much better. But they still adapted to American-style interventionism and internationalism. But it was a lot better than all the fighting and killing that was going on before. So this is. And the argument now is still, they said, well, NATO was wonderful in the economic recovery of Europe. And that's a lie. That's been proven by so many economists that that is not the reason there was recovered. Maybe the failure of communism had something to do with it, but it was manipulated after that in a political way.
Yeah, and it's interesting what Ramzi Baruch writes about this, because His point is that really based, as you just mentioned, NATO was created in a false pretense that this is a world community, we're all going to get along, whereas in reality its first action was to deter communist aggression, supposedly. Put up that next clip. I think he also stumbles upon the real purpose of NATO, and it was to do neither. And this is what he says: the West political discourse wanted to view the civil war in the peninsula prior to NATO's intervention as an example of communist aggression. The aggression supposedly forced NATO's hands to react. But the Korean War was a destructive one. He goes on to say the 75 years since then has proven the flimsiness of the argument, i.e. that NATO had to get involved to counter communist aggression. And they were, and he says the reason is that the Soviet Union has long been dismantled. North Korea has been desperately fighting to break out of its isolation. Yet a fractious state of no war, no peace remains in place. It could turn to a war at any time. So the purpose to counter communist aggression is long past. There is no Soviet Union. This is the part I highlighted, though. And this is, I think, what he's really getting at in the article. However, what that war has achieved is something entirely different. The constant state of non-peace provides a justification for the permanent U.S. military presence in the region.
So what might be the real motivation is the gravy train to the military-industrial complex.
Yeah.
With a pretense that they're saving the world and bringing about peace and economic recovery, which just isn't true.
And that's why the article is so interesting, because he ties it together in a way that I hadn't really thought of. If you go to the next one, he says, okay, so we had no peace in Korea. That means the U.S. had to stay there forever. If you can put the next one on, similar outcomes followed most of NATO's other interventions. Iraq in 91 and 2003, Yugoslavia in 99, Afghanistan 2001, Libya in 2011, and so on. Yet the ability to start or exacerbate conflicts and the inability or perhaps unwillingness to permanently end wars, he goes on to say, is not the real crisis. It is a crisis, but it's not the real crisis. And we'll go into what the real crisis is. But it's a very good point. NATO doesn't come in to create peace and then go home. It goes in to start a conflict and then remain there for years and years and years.
And excuse me, but there's still a lot of conflict, because now there's warring parties between these countries and it's building, and that's the economic wars.
Yeah.
You know, the protectionism that goes on. So the sentiment is still there, and it's going to be remaining there until they decide that internationalism, whether it's international communism or whichever they use, is not the solution to this. And the solution that I always thought occurred was in Vietnam. we just got out of the way and let the Vietnamese start to decide it. And it, you know, it was 20, 30 years, you know, the French were in there for a long time, and then we were in there, and all of a sudden, peace broke out, and far from perfect, but compared to what they had, and just think, now the Vietnamese must be a very worthwhile race, because when they come here, the Vietnamese are very good citizens, and they have family orientation, and yet how many years were they subjected to foreign invaders, the do-gooders, yeah. NATO and United Nations, we'll take care of you and make sure those the Russians never invade Vietnam, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because his conclusion in this article about NATO is they talk about how a lot of blame was put on Trump for disparaging NATO. Remember saying you got to pay up or we're not going to protect you and this and that. But he says that Trump's disparaging comments really were not the instigation of the crisis. They only reflected the growing problems of the crisis. And so there are four crises that he talked about in NATO. And I just want to go over them quickly because I think he makes some very good points. Very important points, very powerful points. If we can put that next one up. So Ramzi Baruth says, NATO's crisis can be summarized as this. First, the geopolitical formations that existed following the collapse of the Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact no longer exist. I.e., the world has completely changed from 30-some years ago. Second, the main aspect, and this is what you just literally just said, Dr. Paul. Second, the main aspect of the new global competition cannot be reduced to military terms. Rather, it is economic. And third, Europe is now largely dependent on energy sources, trade, and even technological integration from countries that the U.S. perceives as enemies, i.e. China, Russia, and others. And finally, the fourth crisis in NATO, and that's the next clip, is that, if you go to the next one here. So fourth, fixing all these challenges and more through the dropping of bombs is no longer the option. They can't be fixed through dropping bombs. The enemy, quote unquote, is far too strong, and the changing nature of warfare makes traditional war largely ineffectual. And this is the part that I highlighted. Though the world has greatly changed, NATO remains committed to a political doctrine from a bygone era. And even if the 2% threshold is met, the problem won't go away. And Baruth's conclusion, it's time for NATO to re-examine its 75-year-old legacy and be courageous enough to change direction altogether instead of opting for a state of non-peace, actually seeking real peace. Now, that's the first part that I would really disagree with Baruth on, is his conclusion that now we're going to keep NATO. Let's just have it work for peace rather than permanent military occupation. I think everything he lays out about the crises is a powerful argument that NATO should not exist. This is not a world where pure force can solve problems or can end things, you know. And I think it's fascinating what he's saying. The conclusion only could be no more NATO.
But he's really challenging the basis of what has happened since World War II, because we won the military war, we won the economic war, we won the effort to get control of the reserve currency of the world, and you know, there were plans to have an empire. But there's a lot of people today understand that and are a little bit more blunt about it, because we have the strength and the wisdom. We have this obligation to do this. I talk about obligations if you know and understand what liberty is all about, but that's not what they're talking about. They're understanding they're powerful, and we might as well maintain the peace by maintaining our empire. So, at the end of World War II, we ended up realizing that, and the plans were well laid, you know, whether it was Bretton Woods or wherever they, you know, started, whenever they started NATO, it was always to gear it up to establish this empire. But guess what? And it worked. It worked to a degree. Right now, what we're witnessing is the unwinding of those many, many years of our wealth being consumed, our liberties being consumed, and our credibility being consumed. Our dollar is crashing, but we're not well respected with our foreign policy either. So it is diametrically different than it was at the end of World War II, because, you know, because we had been attacked at Pearl Harbor, the American people were unified, and that carried over for years and years. And they, I guess the first setback was Vietnam, but it was up to George Bush to dispel that myth. That's not the end of the empire. We'll rebuild in the Middle East. He didn't, that didn't work. So it's smoldering on, but it's always, I see it always as consuming, not building. Yeah. And that the system is consuming what we have. And the worst thing is it's consuming personal liberty, and more people are joining in. I better get my share before it's all gone.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Well, I put up an article on the RonPaulInstitute.org website this morning by one of my favorite and I think most astute analyst, and that's Alistair Crook. He's a retired British diplomat, and he makes a great point in this article. I encourage people to go there and read it. But he's basically saying essentially what Ramsey Broad is saying, which is that the days of domination by using brute force, an overwhelming brute force, have passed. The world has changed. You have now, you're facing asymmetric challenges, and you can no longer bomb your way out of it. And I think a great example of that would be the Houthis. They don't have a very sophisticated military. They don't have a NATO. They don't have the kinds of bombs we have. Yet somehow they've been able to dominate the Red Sea. And there's not a darn thing that the U.S. government, with all of its military power, has been able to do about that. So you're seeing what is being called the resistance, and that includes resistance groups resisting Israel, Hezbollah, Hamas, and others. It includes the Houthis resisting the U.S. Warfare has changed in such a way that the old way of doing it, which is we've got more bombs than you and we're going to win, simply doesn't work anymore.
But you know, the when communism failed in Russia, that was very, very dramatic, but it was also much more peaceful than hardly almost everybody was suspicious that it would be chaotic.
Yeah.
But you know, it just was over and it was faded away, and the opportunities were fantastic. And yet a new system came about because they've been preaching about it, and
yeah,
it came out of our universities. It's economic intervention, but it's sort of a soft type of socialism or welfareism. And this is one, and that economic intervention that was well established during a period of time, it, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, that's sort of what is crumbling and it's disappearing. And I don't think, well, the big question is how is it going to disappear, and how will the new order be built? Because America was prepared for it. Communism failed, and we stepped in, and because of our strength, we were able to dictate all the results. And even though certainly there was a lot of advantages, we still had, you know, a market economy. It was just going to be designed and controlled,
yeah,
by special interests. And I think the obsession with pure democracy was the great contributing effort to continue this, because all you had to do is to get these special interests that enjoyed this is to work together. All we need is 51%.
Yeah.
And we can do whatever we want to the 49%,
yeah,
who will be suffering. And that's what's happening right now. The rich are richer, and those in the poorer class are suffering, and they're bitter, and they don't understand the issue. If they did, they would not ever be supporting, oh, they're going to send me a bigger Social Security check. They're,
yeah,
going to do this, and that's the answer. And it's exactly the wrong thing to do.
Yeah. Well, speaking of a bigger check, let's move on to our next topic. And this is by way of our good friend Dave DeCamp at antiwar.com. If you put that next one up, U.S. is planning a larger than normal weapons package for Ukraine that will include armored vehicles. And so the Senate is expected to pass the $61 billion. Actually, they're putting it all together. $100 billion foreign aid package to Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan. It's supposed to pass today. It'll probably go to Biden tonight, and he'll sign it. And they're going to have a huge tranche of weapons that they're going to send over. And apparently, most of these weapons were already sitting in warehouses in Poland and Germany right now, getting ready to send over. And they'll be shipped over very quickly. They're saying that the first tranche will be about $1 billion worth of weapons. And it will include, in fact, if we go to the next one, it will include some Bradleys. It'll include some ATACMS missiles with a range of about 190 miles. And also something significant, and we'll have to keep an eye out on this, is that the ATACMS that they've been using, Dr. Paul, have had the cluster bomb warheads on them, which are not very good. They're good for anti-personnel, but they're not very good for blowing things up like bridges, like the Kerch Bridge. So I wonder if when these new ATACMS come, if Ukraine is going ahead and going to return to its fantasy of blowing up the Kerch Bridge, which I think could be a huge escalation. But whatever the case, the weapons are there, they're ready to go, they're going to hit the battlefield very, very soon.
And it seems like the control of the scenario and the media keeps the people in check and encouraged, and they go along with it. But there's splitting on that now. We realize that the people are less enthusiastic about it. But it is going to be the disappearance of all the wealth that we've been able to consume that will finally stop this. And I see every day evidence of this happening. You know, all you have to do is compare the street people in this country for the last 10 years. And it's skyrocketing, and the evidence is so clear, and yet people are still confused that they still don't know the difference, because they say that it's so clear. If you look at which cities are the worst, which states are the worst, and it's very clear cut. They took if you take the four or five large cities run by the authoritarians who say that we can take care of everybody, and we have a heart, and we care, we're humanitarians, and it's a total failure. So will they come to the point of throwing up their hands like the communists did and peacefully walk away from it? You know, it just failed, and Khrushchev, Gorbachev, he just walked away, didn't drop a bomb to try, and yet all through those decades, they were dropping bombs anytime there was a resistance to it, but they were totally bankrupt. And the big question is, how is this going to evolve? Will there be a replacement? And that's where I see the activity that I'm interested in, and that is the action among some intellectuals and that are producing the information and understanding of economics and what liberty is all about, rather than saying, okay, I think the Ivy League schools, it seems like they could have another job. We better give them another job, and maybe they'll give us some ideas about good economic policy and good social policies.
Yeah. Not likely. But, you know, Brian Berletic, who I follow, he's a former U.S. Marine. I think he's a very astute military analyst. He makes an interesting point. First of all, Ukraine has had a severe shortage of weapons. They've had to severely cut back on the artillery that they fire toward Russia. And this has been written about in all the mainstream papers. They've cut back. In fact, they've cut back their ATACMS fires to only about 16 missiles a day, which in a big, broad war with a thousand kilometer front line, 16 missiles a day is not a lot when you think about Russia's firepower. But Brian Berletic did a little bit of math, and I wanted to just share it with you, Dr. Paul, and with our viewers, because it's fascinating. You have a Ukraine that's severely constricted, only firing 16 a day. But Brian Berletic points out, back in reality, current HIMARS guided rocket production, 6,000 a year, is incapable of matching even Ukraine's meager daily average, CNN reported last year as 18 a day. If every rocket produced is sent to Ukraine, which is impossible, the maximum rate of fire would be 16 per day. So the fact is, when they were in the gravy and they had all these missiles and they were firing them, they were firing missiles that can't be replaced because they're only making them at a rate that they could be fired at 16 per day. And he has a couple of backups. I just want to put them on really quick. A couple of articles where that demonstrates this. I don't know if it's a little bit small, it's hard to read, but so he talks about, Lockheed Martin plans to ramp up production from 6,000 rockets a year to 14,000 a year. And that is the plan, but as of right now, $100,000 a year from this article. And if you go to the next one, the Ukrainian forces fired 16 rockets without issue, about the daily rate of the past few weeks. So they are firing 18, but if they even ramp up production, and actually if you put the next one on, he points out, even if Lockheed produces as much as it claims, hey, we're going to ramp it up to 14,000 a year, that will only mean if we give them every single one of our missiles, that's still only 38 missiles a day, and that won't come online until 2025, another year from now. So I'm sorry, it's a long-winded way of saying we can't make enough weapons for Ukraine to make a difference. So why are we sending everything we have?
Well, shouldn't we celebrate? The end is near.
Yeah.
Except they'll figure out something else to do.
It's just, it's just astonishing, this war. And even the mainstream is saying this war cannot be won, but we're going to give them a little time. That seems a little bit cruel, doesn't it?
The discouraging thing is, we have more freedom than a lot of countries. We have a lot of organizations similar to what we try to do. The information is out there, and yet the people don't say, that's right. Why are we doing this? And that whole mess, and we'll probably talk about that in a little bit more, about how the speaker didn't serve our interests in getting this stuff passed or held back. But I'm just discouraged that the American people, although many are waking up, they don't have a very good voice. But I think it has to do with who really controls it. You know, we make fun of the mainstream media and everybody gets their information from the internet. But evidently, you can't say, well, that's good news, and the majors are going to lose all influence, because they must have still a lot of influence on the people who aren't arguing the case for changing our policies.
Yes, for sure. Well, we've gone a little bit over, but we did want to, as you mentioned, as you sort of indicated, we want to talk a little bit about something we noticed in Politico's playbook today, if we can put that up. And it's just speculation. We have no idea what's going on. We have no idea what the answer is. But, Marjorie Taylor Greene has been very upfront about opposing the aid to Ukraine. She's been very forthright. She's been joined by Massey and a few others. But she's also known as being very close to Donald Trump. So they write in Playbook, it turns out it wasn't a momentary lapse of judgment. Donald Trump yesterday evening defended Speaker Mike Johnson for the second time in as many weeks amid a swirl of speculation about his future atop the House GOP. So it's very interesting. Trump said Johnson is trying very hard and a very good person, right when he's under the strongest fire by his other allies in Congress, like Marjorie Taylor Greene and others.
So it's very dramatic. You can see what's going on, the contest between Mike Johnson and the likes of Marjorie Taylor Greene. And, her ability to have gotten attention the last few years is impressive.
Yeah.
And fortunately, she sort of gets on our side a lot of the time. She's sick and tired of the whole thing. But then you take the two of them going at it, and you have the media reporting on all this and politicizing every single word. And then you put Trump in the middle of it.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder if Trump would have looked like a very weak person. I wonder if you could argue the case it might have been more appropriate for maybe just deal with that when he's president and when he has a job of signing a bill or something. But this influence, and then it wouldn't be so bad if he was always arguing our case.
Yeah, we'd like that.
But he'll flip-flop-flu. Just as Johnson did, and then that raises more questions. Some of the conservatives got mad at Trump
for doing
this. So it's just too bad they don't have a firm grasp of a single principle of non-intervention and personal liberty, and it solves a lot of problems in deciding what should we do with all our money.
Let's give it back. But it is interesting. I mean, he's praising Johnson. Now, before, he was opposed to sending all this money to Ukraine. I mean, Trump was very, very obviously opposed to it, vocally opposed to it. He softened a little and said, I'll make it a loan, But here you have him saying, well, Johnson did a good job and everyone is furious. Well, here's this is from the same playbook. Put the next one on. So Steve Bannon here's what he claims. He claims that don't buy this stuff that that Trump thinks Johnson is fine. He said Steve Bannon, who had been close to Trump in the past and is apparently close to him now, he claimed that Trump was furious about what happened with Johnson's support of foreign aid spending and that Trump had been manipulated by political operatives into backing the rookie speaker. Now, that's what Bannon claims. We don't know if that's the case or not. Is Trump furious with Johnson, or is he happy with Johnson, or is he furious but doesn't want to pick a fight? And they mentioned as well, when you have a one-person majority in the House. But whatever the case, I think it's pretty clear that passing this money is a political lifeline to the Joe Biden reelection campaign.
You know, we report and talk about this, and the main conclusion is very confusing, it's very mixed. Why are the people doing all this? And I think it's because the sides are getting at each other, but neither side has a real understanding and following a certain principle, because a lot of people, a lot of supporters of Trump will say, well, that's not true. Everybody knows what Trump stands for, but that's not the case. What about a Christian conservative that becomes the Speaker of the House, who took certain very strong conservative financial position, and all of a sudden he flip-flop.
Yeah.
And the only side that seems to be elated is the Mike Schumer, Schumer people.
Yeah, Chuckie Schumer,
He's delighted.
He's happy.
We got everything we wanted.
Yeah, yeah.
So why doesn't that wake up some people? Yeah, they're waiting for it all to disappear, and then they'll pick up the pieces. But that's when the real danger comes. And the danger is coming up all the time. Every day we're seeing, more violence and more street people. And, of course, the big thing is I do believe in the invasion principle. We're being invaded, and they're set up so that when this thing breaks down, they're going to have, just the demonstration on the campuses.
Yeah.
We're for peaceful demonstrations. But what if a lot of the most violent demonstrators on campuses have all been planted there through this immigration problem?
Yeah.
And I believe that's very possible. We don't even know who came in.
Yeah.
And
no idea.
All of a sudden, they might be the instigators. They might be the organizers, for all we know, because it certainly hasn't happened quite like this. And it's so unusual that it's been anti-Semitic type thing thrown in there, which is very unusual for our country to get that aggressive on it. There's been a bit of it, and it exists, but all of a sudden all the universities would do that, and they think it's part of their progressivism.
Well, I think a lot of young people are looking at the slaughter in Gaza, though, and they're rightly upset about it, and I think that's a legitimate protest when you've killed 34,000 women and children.
Right.
You're going to have a reaction to it. But I'm just going to close out now, I guess, then, and just thank everyone for watching the show. I mentioned RonPaulInstitute.org. That's our website. I mentioned it in the past. We publish just a couple of articles a day. We've got two really good ones up today that I encourage. The first from the aforementioned Alistair Crook. We have another one from a retired Indian diplomat, M.K. Bhairakumar, who I think is also a very, very insightful. It's often good to look outside the box, look at people who are thinking about things a little bit differently from the outside and looking in. So I highly recommend those two articles as well. And I thank you for watching our program. I'm going to turn it back over to you, Dr. Paul.
Very good. I think people, if they wonder, what kind of a foreign policy should we have? Don't we have this moral obligation to go around the world and make it safe for democracy? No, I don't think we have the moral obligation to use some other life, take their life and take their money and go and mold the world the way we think it should be. And that's what's happened. But the founders were very clear on the advice they gave us about this. They talked about non-intervention, stay out of the affairs, stay out of the internal affairs of other nations. And they also talked about staying out of entangling alliances. And we talked about some entangling alliances here. NATO, it's been entangled for all these years, but we never wake up. And then if Trump does say something good, it's being held against him right now. There's political pressure, which it seems at times he might respond to. But he he'll change his mind too. And it's all of a sudden, Daniel mentioned again. We talked about it yesterday. I think the speaker's doing okay. And we've added in there. We're not going to just give him this money. We're going to call it a loan. But we can't even collect a loan back when we loan it to some people here who want to get a scholarship. You know, it's just so foolish. And then the silly part about that, Daniel, was they have a clause in that passing it back, which was just Biden talking. Mm-hmm. Oh, we're going to let that's only for a couple months. After a month, they can default.
Yeah,
you know?
I wish I had that kind of
law. Yeah, so anyway, I don't think it's complicated. Non-intervention and having a goal for a government to be very limited, because protecting liberty isn't confusing. And the outline is there. We should have our privacy. We should have our freedom of our religious beliefs. We should not ever commit violent crimes against each other. We should not defraud. We cannot counterfeit the money. Yeah, we let the government do all these things. This is one reason why I've always marveled at some of the advice from Bastia. You know, it's so simple. If you and I can't do it, and the government has a lot of rules on what we can't do, but the government can. No, it should be, if you and I can't do it, how does the government get the authority to do this? So if we can't steal from our neighbor, why should we send our congressman to steal from our neighbor and redistribute wealth? So it's not that complex. And I think anybody with a little common sense and a little bit of openness in their minds, they can accept this idea of non-intervention and personal liberty is a far cry from the stuff that we're getting from our government now. I want to thank everybody for tuning in today to the Liberty Report. Please come back soon.